It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. When you pick up a newspaper and you read about Africa today, it's all Ebola and child soldiers and Boko Haram. Here in the U.S., these just seem to be the stories we want to tell about Africa. But you know, there's more to the continent than bleak headlines. In fact, there's a whole new wave of fiction coming out of Africa, and some of it is a lot of fun. Want to hear about Nigerian science fiction or Somali fantasy? Ella Wakatama Alfrey from Zimbabwe has just put together an anthology of 39 new young African writers. And she thinks that the African continent is the most exciting literary scene on the planet today.
For a long time, literature coming out of Africa that has been most recognized as literary fiction. But what really thrills me is the introduction of really good genre fiction, crime, some fantasy. There's a lot of really interesting work going on with science fiction. And I think this sort of widening out to sort of satisfy all kinds of readers is what makes me feel especially thrilled.
That's one of the things that is so fascinating, because up until now, the stars of African literature, and I'm thinking about the post-colonial period, were very politically engaged writers, you know, people like Chinua Achebe and Wole Soyinka. But it sounds like the new younger writers are, a lot of the writing is really not politically driven.
Well, perhaps not directly so. And really, when we start talking about Soyinka or Achebe or Mungoshi or any of those writers, we're talking about our grandfathers or our elderly fathers, for mm-hmm. example. And so, really, this is a post-colonial generation. And frankly, I'd rather just leave the colonial out of it, because that discussion isn't really a part of what I see and what I'm most excited being written about. Of course, many of the writers are living in countries that have a colonial legacy, and that can't be denied. But it's not their main concern. Their concern is what is happening now. And I would say, really, that I can't think of a single writer who isn't socially engaged, even those writers who are writing maybe romance or fantasy. You can't live in a country that's part of the developing world, as it's called, and not be engaged socially. But that doesn't mean that it has to be as obviously political as maybe writing in the past was.
Can you give me an example of some of the kinds of things you're seeing being written today that maybe wouldn't have been written or possibly couldn't have been written even a decade ago?
Well, I don't know that anything couldn't have been written, but I would say rather that things are finding publication that maybe wouldn't have found publication before. So, for example, one of my favorite bright new talents is a writer from Kenya called Mehul Gohil, who is Indian. But he is an Indian who was born in Kenya to parents who were Kenyan themselves and really considers himself an African. And he's writing a very African experience that wouldn't have been possible in a previous generation, because someone like him wouldn't have existed. And he has a style that's very heavily influenced by writers from Europe, but also writers from the African continent as well. And so I think something like that is sort of diaspora, but in another way that's not often talked about, is really quite exciting. I'm a publisher by training and profession, and often publishers want to put things into little boxes. I find great delight in stories that refuse those boxes.
Wole Soyinka wrote the introduction to your anthology, and one of the things he says is that for a long time in the early days of the African nations, it was not possible for a writer to be politically neutral, partly because, as he says, the creative writer was a primary objective in the struggle for power. So the creative writer, the position of a writer in many of those early African nations was a political position. You couldn't avoid it. You know, you were either, the national leaders were either opposing or trying to repress you or trying to co-opt you. And it sounds like, you know, it's a very different situation that writers are writing in today.
I agree that co-opting is no longer the case. I think that Professor Soyinka is absolutely right. It's no longer necessary. I don't think I would agree that the writers were not being political. So, for example, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who opens the book, her story, The Shivering, talks about a friendship between two Nigerians living in America, and one of the characters is a gay man. writing about a gay character is a hugely political act, especially if you're coming from countries that are enacting vile legislation against the gay community. And so while it's a story about this friendship, it's a story about diaspora in many ways, it's a story about religion too. For me, it's a very political story. And I was really pleased to open the book with a story that tackled that issue head on. And so I guess that weight of having to obviously be political or having obviously to tackle social issues, it's a burden that these writers have either chosen or it maybe never occurred to them to carry that burden. And as a reader, I'm deeply grateful because I think it makes for a kind of subtlety that's absolutely essential.
That's so fascinating that you said there's a kind of burden they don't feel required to carry anymore. What's the burden?
Well, you know, it's very interesting for me because it's been very interesting listening to reactions to this collection from writers in Bangladesh and India, for example, and across the African continent, as opposed to writers in London or in the United States. The reviewers in the United States, London, are very concerned about form and the way that anthology should be. And perhaps disappointingly for me, not engaging with the story so much, because it is, I guess, in the end, a mishmash, because the writers are from so many different countries and writing some different genres. It's that burden of the way things are supposed to be. Do you have to be political? Do you have to talk about poverty or war or corruption? You know, what form does a short story take? What form does a novel take? All of those things are burdens. And I think that this kind of self-invention that I feel all of the writers I worked with have undertaken. And that's not saying it's an ignoring of the past or ignoring of history, but it certainly for me is a self-invention that shrugs off all of those burdens and, you know, maybe even doesn't acknowledge them.
So it's not that these younger writers are politically or socially disengaged. It's more that it's a moment of liberation.
Absolutely. And the one thing they are very much is engaged. These are stories, and this is writing about place and about people. And the really important themes are all there. The things that make literature valuable and the things that make reading important are all here. I can't emphasize that enough. There's a deep engagement here. But it's perhaps not the engagement one would expect when one sorts of approaches African literature all in capital letters.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say, switching from thinking about these stories from a writer's perspective or a publisher's or editor's perspective and thinking about them simply from the perspective of a reader, somebody, maybe somebody white with no particular connection to or great knowledge of African nations and what it's like to live anywhere in Africa today, what would a reader get out of some of these stories, do you think?
Oh, that's wonderful. What a wonderful thought. I just had a vision of somebody opening the book for the first time and starting off on this incredible journey.
It is a journey. It's dizzying and probably as confusing and exciting as it would be to step off a plane in Nairobi.
Well, I wonder. I think that I would invite the person, if they were asking themselves this question, to switch it around and imagine what somebody first experiences when they pick up a novel that's written by an American, Joshua Ferris, for example, and what they find there. One finds a lot that's familiar because we're all human beings. We live in families. We live in societies with our neighbors. We have friends. We have lovers. We do bad things sometimes. You know, and this is the stuff that stories are made of. And so, you know, just as an African reader reading a European novel, for example, or a North American novel would experience those things and recognize them, as well as experiencing things that are completely new. You know, you're reading a Mennonite novel and they're all eating shufai pie or something like that. You know, you know, what is that? And sometimes you won't know what it is and you may have to go and look it up. Sometimes it's fine not to know because the context will tell you and it teaches you something about the people. I mean, all of those joys of discovery that one finds in any book are there here. I guess what is special is that for me as a reader and even though I've been speaking as a publisher, first and foremost, what I am is, you know, is a reader. And I discovered that I really need to go to Kinshasa because Richard Alimutu writes about this sexy, vibrant place that completely blew away everything I had read or thought I knew about the Congo. And that's what a good story is supposed to do.
Ella, this has been great. Thank you so much for introducing us to some wonderful new writers.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Happy reading.
Thanks. Ella Wakatama-Alfrey is an editor and publisher from Zimbabwe. And we were talking about her new book called Africa 39. It's a collection of stories from 39 African writers under the age of 40. So with all these great new books out there, let's get started reading.
I was both excited and frightened to think of studying with a stranger, for I was shy around him and found his green gaze disconcerting. I could not see how he would teach me, since we shared no common language, but I joined him dutifully in the schoolroom that opened onto the back garden.
That's a little selection from A Stranger in Olandria. It's a novel that swept this year's Fantasy Awards, and it's by a writer named Sophia Samatar. She's Somali by birth, raised in the U.S., and she wrote this book while she was living through a civil war in what is now South Sudan. The main character, the narrator, is a young guy named Jevik. He's the son of a wealthy merchant, and his life is forever changed by the arrival of a mysterious new teacher. Steve Paulson asked Sophia to read some more.
He began by taking me by the wrist and leading me around the room, pointing to things and naming them, signing that I should repeat. When I had learned the names of all the objects in the schoolroom, he took me into the kitchen garden and named the vegetables. If there were plants he did not know, he pointed and raised his gull-gray eyebrows, which meant that he wished to learn the Kideti word. He carried with him always a leather satchel of very fine make, in which he kept another leather object, dyed peacock blue. When he opened it, sheets of rich cotton paper spread out like a fan, some of them marked with minute patterns which he had made himself. The satchel had a narrow pocket sewn to an outside edge, fastened shut with a metal clasp and set with bits of turquoise. And in this, my new master kept two or three miraculous ink pens, filled only once a day, with which he made marks in his vallon. Whenever I told him a word in our language, he took out his blue leather book, wrote something in it rapidly, and thanked me with a bow. I was puzzled, for though I admired the book as more cunning than our wooden blocks, I could not understand why he wished to keep track of the number of words he had learned.
Oh, that is such a wonderful passage. And one thing that's so fascinating about your story is you're introducing us to the world of books, the wonders that are created by writing, by books that name things, that introduce us to new worlds. But yet, on the other hand, it seems like maybe the act of reading is removing us to some degree from the actual experience of the world, of the world that Jevik grew up in, in his oral culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's as much as it's a novel about reading, it's also a novel about exile. I mean, there's Jevik's tutor who has left his home and is experiencing exile, and then there's Jevik's own journey to Olandria and that experience of change, which involves loss. And I suppose there's a way in which the book draws a parallel between those things, that reading, to be absorbed in a book, is to be in a different place and to be in a different space. And there can be, feelings of loss when a book ends, and also feelings of maybe having lost some actual experiences that you might have had in the world because you were reading.
Now, to add to the paradox here, it turns out that writing in this new land of Olandria can be a tool of oppression. It can be something that supports the military and the ruling class.
Yes, and that's true of our world too. This is something that became sort of a preoccupation of mine as I was writing the book, because I was working, and this was my first, the first time that I'd had sort of a full-time job for more than a year, and I was teaching English in a high school in South Sudan. And this seems like a great thing to do. And I think that in many ways it was a great thing to do. But the place I was working in was operating almost entirely in an oral mode. There was very little reading material, and the vast majority of people did not read. And so not only was I teaching people to read and write, teaching them to read and write English, a different language, and so I really started asking myself questions about what I was contributing to. You know, we hear about language death. We know English is a global language and everybody wants to have it, but there are things that are lost along that path.
Did you ever feel like you were maybe working in the language of cultural imperialism there, that there might have been something wrong with
sure,
trying to teach these kids English?
Absolutely. Yeah. Although, you know, my students passionately wanted to learn it, as, you know, of course, you know, it was a gateway to many things, especially also because I was working in an area of Sudan. This was still during that civil war that was going on at the time.
Well, you were teaching in a high school during a civil war?
Yes, but in a place that was very far from the front. I mean, from areas of, obviously you can't run a school in a place where there's active conflict. It was under the control of the SPLA, the rebel group, and not of the Khartoum government. And so my students had begun their education in Arabic and were now switching to English in order to make closer connections with their neighbors in Uganda and Kenya.
Did it ever get dicey for you? I mean, given these warring allegiances?
We were evacuated one time in the 3 years that we were there. So that was one time when it was dicey. And then there was another time when our school was closed because there was a general conscription. This was actually a conscription into the SPLA. And our school, we had 300 students, and about 30 of them were young women. So it was almost all young men. And so we had to close for a time.
How old were the boys when they were conscripted?
The average age of a student in our school was 21. Their education had been disrupted in most cases. Either they had been away, they had been in refugee camps, mostly in Congo, or some of them had been soldiers as well, had been child soldiers.
This must have made all this very real to you. I mean, coming back to this notion that, you know, you're writing a book of fantasy here, but to some degree it's based in a war experience. And you're writing about that too. I mean, there are these warring factions in your novel.
There are. And there's also, I mean, the ghost who comes to haunt Jevik is the ghost of someone who died far too young, who died as a teenager. And that was an idea that was very present to me in working with those students, and also because I was 26. I wasn't very old either.
Now, you talked about your own experience of working on this book, and you wrote it for a long time. Were you actually writing back when you were teaching in South Sudan?
Yes, that's where I wrote the first draft.
So, I mean, so you were writing during a time of war.
Yes.
Was it hard to focus on what you were doing?
No. I think in a lot of ways it was a refuge. You know, so I wanted to go to this other space every day.
That's Sophia Samatar talking with Steve Paulson. She was born in Somalia and raised in the U.S., and she's lived and taught in both the Sudan and Egypt. They were talking about her novel, A Stranger in Olandria, which won the World Fantasy Award for Best Novel this year. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Abi bandele, abi mama de luka bisote abi bele don se be mont. Abi bandele,
We're talking about the new wave of popular fiction coming out of Africa today. And here's something I bet you haven't encountered. African science fiction. So you know how whenever aliens come to Earth, they're always landing in places like Arizona or Iowa? Well, this time, they show up in Lagos, Nigeria. That's the premise of Lagoon, a new science fiction novel from Nnedi Okorafor.
Only two people on the beach witnessed the watery abduction of Adora and the two men. One was a young boy. His stomach was growling, but he forgot about his hunger for the moment. In the moonlight, he couldn't clearly see the creature, but as it walked out of the water, even he knew it wasn't human. All his mind would register was the word smoke. At least until the creature walked up to the quiet beach and stepped into the flickering light from one of the restaurants. By then, it had become a naked, dark-skinned African woman with long black braids. She reminded the boy of a woman whose purse he'd once stolen. She'd stood there for several moments watching the three people who came from three different directions and ended up standing right before each other. Then the strange woman creature silently ran back to the water and dove in like Mammy Wata. Rubbing his itchy head, the boy decided that he was seeing things, as he often did when he grew confused. He flared his nostrils and breathed through his mouth as he tried to focus back on reality. The great booming sound rattled his brain even more. Then came the wave that looked like the hand of a powerful water spirit. The boy saw it take the three people, one who was a woman and two who were men. And just before it did, he saw one of those people throw a black bird into the air that caught itself and flew into the night. Nevertheless, he could not speak or even process any of this information, for he was both mute and mentally handicapped. He stared at where the three people had been and now were not. Then he smiled. Saliva glistening in the left corner of his mouth, because somewhere deep in his restrained brain, he had a profound understanding that things around him were about to change forever, and he liked this idea very much.
Nnedi, that's from near the beginning of your most recent book, the science fiction novel Lagoon. Give us a thumbnail sketch. What happens in the book?
Lagos means lagoon in the language of Portuguese. And so Lagoon is very much about the city of Lagos. And so a snapshot of it would be aliens come to the city of Lagos, Nigeria, and things happen because of that.
Basically all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, well.
And then the spirits and the ancestors come out to see what's going on.
Yes, all the people of Nigeria, of that area, come to meet the aliens, come to see what's going on. So when you talk about people, it's not just the human beings. You know, we're talking about the plants, the animals, and the ancestors and spirits. So yes, yes. Mm.
Now, I've read that there's a backstory here, that your decision to write the book also maybe has something to do with your reaction to the science fiction movie District 9.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I saw District 9, watched it with my sisters, and we had a very strong reaction. I had a very strong reaction to the film. And
you hated it.
Well, there were parts of it that I actually loved, but there were aspects of it that I absolutely hated. And the main thing that I despised, that I detested, was the portrayal of Nigerians in the film. It was highly bigoted and problematic.
People who don't remember?
Well, Nigerians were basically portrayed as criminals, cannibals, thugs, just every single negative you can think of. And they were basically summarily stereotyped. So there was not one Nigerian that was not problematic in the film. And it was very clear because they were referred to as the Nigerians. It was something that just stuck out like a sore thumb in this kind of film. And so when I saw this film, you know, of course, it sparked a very strong reaction within me as a Nigerian, but also it got my wheels turning. It got me thinking about aliens, and then it got me thinking about what would happen if aliens actually landed in Nigeria. And then once I settled on that part of the country in my head, I started thinking, what would be the best place for this to happen? And of course, I thought Lagos.
Why? Why Lagos?
Lagos is, I like to describe it as New York on crack. Everything happens there. There's so much energy, positive and negative. There's just so much coming out of that city. It's the perfect place for an alien invasion to happen, especially as a writer, because writers look for conflict. We look for excitement. We look for just life and energy. And yeah, it was the perfect place to set the story.
Well, I'm curious, so much speculative fiction tends to be rooted in a culture's mythologies. You know, and Africa, of course, is a continent filled with storytellers and so many different rich mythologies. Did you draw on any Nigerian mythology or storytelling traditions in any of this?
Oh, certainly. As I said, that the people that come to meet these aliens when they do come to Lagos are not just the humans, and it's not just, it includes the creatures, it includes animals, plants, and the ancestors and spirits. And so when we're talking spirits, I was drawing from Yoruba mythology and Igbo mythology specifically. We've got masquerades that come up. Masquerades are manifestations of the spirits and the ancestors, and they can come in many shapes and sizes. So we've got one of the greatest masquerades of all masquerades amongst the Igbos named Ijele, who comes and meets the aliens. We've got Papa Legba in there, who is the deity of language and the crossroads, who comes in. Then we've got the road monster, which is more my creation. Well, the road monster is a blend of many things for me, because a lot of times I will blend mythology with other things. And in this case, we've got the road monster, which was one of the things in Nigeria that are most dangerous are the roads. Yeah. The roads are a scary place, and I've always seen those roads as filled with ghosts. Okay. And that's where the road monster came from. Huh. So not to give away too much, but yeah.
Nettie, before you go, you have a brand new book just about to go to press. Can we get a sneak
yes.
peek? What's it about?
Yes, The Book of Phoenix. Now, The Book of Phoenix is a oh, boy, you want to talk about things that you can't categorize. This is The Book of Phoenix is like, people are going to be wondering, is it science fiction? Is it fantasy? What the heck is this?
Does it have a plot?
It does. It has a very, very strong plot. It is the prequel to Who Fears Death. So where my novel Who Fears Death is a post-apocalyptic novel that takes place in Sudan, far in the future. This is set probably about maybe about 100 years from now. And it is about a woman who, okay, there are several towers that are in the United States that are used for scientific experimentation of many different types. And within one of these towers, Tower 7, there's a woman who has been grown named Phoenix. She's only 2 years old, but she looks like she's 40. And she's been happy. And then one day, the man that she loves, who is also one of the experiments in Tower 7, one day he kills himself. And when he does that, she kind of wakes up and starts yearning for her freedom. And so the Book of Phoenix is what happens when she decides that she wants to escape. And a lot happens because of that.
Wow.
So that's, yes. And it starts off in the city of New York, but it does not stay there.
How does it begin? Is there a bit you could read?
Let me see. I think there should be. Let me see if I can grab that. I just finished this, so just a moment. There is no book about me, the voice said. Well, not yet. No matter. I shall create it myself. It's better that way. To tell you my tale, I will use the old African tools of story, spoken words. They're worthier of my trust, and they'll last longer. And during shadowy times, spoken words carry farther than words typed, imaged, or written. My beginnings were in the dark. We all dwelled in the dark, mad scientists and specimen alike. A dear friend of mine would say that this time was when the goddess Anis slept. I call my story The Book of Phoenix. It is reliable and short because it was accelerated.
Oh, that's beautiful. Oh, wow. Well, I guess we're ending with a beginning. That's a sneak
yes.
peek of Nettie Okorafor's next book, which hasn't even got to press yet. So you heard it here first. Nettie, thanks you so much for talking.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Nnedi Okorafor is the author of a whole bunch of award-winning fantasy and science fiction novels. We were talking about her most recent, which is called Lagoon, but keep an eye out for that next one.
The window of Rocket Coffee gives Jono the perfect view of the hollow shell of Michigan Central Station, the Acropolis of Detroit.
South African writer Lauren Bucus.
Some genius suggested preserving the iconic ruins. That's what everyone's here for anyway, to gawp at the broken buildings, take their portraits. The only difference between the hipsters breaking into abandoned buildings here and the middle-aged tourists in socks and sandals in the Colosseum is that the former use more filters on their photographs and the latter have audio guides. Not a bad idea, actually.
That's Lauren Bucus reading from her new novel, Broken Monsters. So we've been talking this hour about the next wave of African fiction and how young writers across the continent are breaking out of the old literary boxes. Broken Monsters definitely does that. It's a crime novel written by a white South African and set in Detroit, USA. Doug Gordon wondered, why Detroit?
Because Detroit is the go-to cliche, the go-to metaphor for the death of the American dream. And a lot of people see it as a broken and ruined city, and it's really not. It has a lot of huge problems. And there is a lot of urban decay, and there are boarded up buildings, but at the same time, it's also somewhere people live. And I really wanted to get under the skin of that. But I'm also interested in the collective unconscious of cities and abandoned places and kind of these places which are metaphors and symbols, like Detroit, and what that means and how that plays out and how we work with that in our collective storytelling, if that doesn't sound way too pretentious.
No, that doesn't sound pretentious at all. Did you visit Detroit to do research?
Of course. I'm an ex-journalist, and I believe very strongly in trying to get the spirit of a place right that I'm writing about. So I visited Detroit just before I started writing the novel, and then after I'd finished the first draft to do kind of checkups on things that I needed to fill in the gaps on. I hung out with Detroit homicide detectives, and I walked them through the case and actually made them solve it. It was great. and we talked about the procedure and how they would handle things like an art party where a body is discovered and you have to lock down 400 people. You know, how would the cops actually deal with that? How long does it take to get CSI results? What leads would they be following? But I also hung out with Detroit's theater teenagers, who gave me some amazing insights into social media and how they live their lives right now. Like, they said to me, if all the world's a stage, that stage is social media. And the rest of our lives is what happens backstage and in the wings, preparing to put on that show. And that developed into a major theme in the book, is who we are on social media and these different kinds of lives that we live. So I really try to get under the skin and quite deep into the city.
Detroit used to symbolize the American dream, but these days it's more like the opposite of that, the American nightmare, mm-hmm. which I suppose in a way is only fitting considering how dreams and nightmares figure in your book. Can you talk a bit about
Absolutely.
That without giving too much away?
Yep. It comes up fairly early in the book that the killer is an artist, a failed artist who feels ignored and sidelined and thwarted and a failure. He encounters something in the woods and he feels like he is possessed by a kind of a muse or perhaps a dream that is taking on his form and trying to remake the world in its image. It's quite a naive force, really. It really is just trying to make the world as it sees it, which should be malleable, where things should be able to, you should be able to create new creatures and have them come to life and, you know, jump around on their new feet. It's a very strange and disturbing killer. He's not a typical serial killer at all. And I think he really struggles with what's happening to him. And the creative urge or ambition or dream, which is possessing him, doesn't really know what it's doing.
Yeah, and the dream that it's really present, that it's like beyond a part of the killer. It's very much its own entity in the sense that towards the end of the novel, you use the dream as the subject of a sentence, like the dream pulled the car, parked the car, you know, at
yeah,
such and such a place.
Absolutely, but of course it is also, you know, the things which leak through from our subconscious and the darkness that haunts us in cities. You know, I think all cities are haunted. I think places like Detroit in particular, haunted by history and haunted by, you know, the social issues and the people. And this also ties in very much to the internet and how the internet is so much our collective unconscious and where also the unconscious comes to vent. In the internet and in dreams.
Yeah, yeah. This would be a good time to have you read an excerpt from the beginning of Broken Monsters. Would you mind?
Absolutely. Detective, the uniform says, because Gabriella is just standing there, staring down at the kid in the deep shadow of the tunnel, her hands jammed in the pocket of her jacket. She left her damn gloves in the car, and her fingers are numb from the chill wind sneaking in off the river. Winter baring its teeth, even though it's only November. Are you... Yeah, okay, she cuts him off, reading the name on his badge. I'm thinking about the adhesive, Officer Jones. Because mere superglue wouldn't do it. Holding the pieces together while the body was moved? This isn't where the kid died. There's not enough blood on the scene. And there's no sign of his missing half. Black. No surprise in the city. 10 years old, she'd guess. Maybe older if you factored in malnourishment and development issues. Say somewhere between 10 and 16. Naked. As much of him as there is to be naked. It's entirely possible that the rest of him is wearing pants, with his wallet in the back pocket and a cell phone that won't have any minutes, but which will make calling his mama a hell of a lot easier. Wherever the rest of him is. He's lying on his side, his legs pulled up, eyes closed, face serene. The recovery position. Only, he's never going to recover, and those aren't his legs. Skinny as a beanpole, beautiful skin, even if it's gone yellow from blood loss. Pre-adolescent, she decides. No sign of acne. No scratches or bruises either, or any indication that he put up a fight or had anything bad happen to him at all. Above the waist. Below the waist is a different story. Oh boy, that's a whole other section of the bookstore. There is a dark gash right above where his hips should be, where he has been somehow attached to the lower half of a deer, hooves and all. The white flick of the tail sticks up like a jaunty little flag. The brown fur is bristled with dried blood. The flesh appears melted together at the seam.
That is a very powerful and horrific image. Where did this idea of having the killer create this mutant animal people hybrid mashups come from?
My twisted mind. I was thinking of kind of very surreal imagery. On my Tumblr, I've been collecting images of kind of half human, half animals. I was very interested in masks and how we obfuscate our features and how we kind of lose a sense of ourselves. And I think sometimes in the creative process, that definitely happens. If you are kind of reaching out for this greater creativity, this collective unconscious that's out there, you know, what are you actually tapping into when you create something? But it's also, it's very much kind of Puck from A Midsummer Night's Dream. And as somebody pointed out to me on Twitter, I've essentially killed Mr. Tumnus from Narnia, which I thought was a very astute reading because you know, Clayton does draw these doors because he's trying to break through to the other side. He's trying to, you know, open a door into a different kind of world. And this boy is not the lovely, charming Mr. Tumnus from Narnia. He is, you know, it's a sad, terrible, savage thing that's happened. And he's not going to get up. And it is that kind of destructive side of the creative urge,
yeah.
The damage that can happen as well.
Lauren Bucus lives and writes in South Africa. She and Doug Gordon were talking about her new crime novel, Broken Monsters. So we're going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll change the subject and catch up with an American poet, Claudia Rankine, and her best-selling poem, Citizen. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
My name is Hans-Ulrich Obrist. We are the 27th day of the first month of the 15th year of the second decade of the first century of the third millennium in London. And I want to talk about the idea of a palace of unbuilt roads. In 1850, the Crystal Palace happened. In 1960s, Cedric Price and John Littlewood came up with this idea of the Fun Palace. And my idea was always to actually build a palace of unbuilt roads. There are many, many reasons why projects can be unrealized. And very often the most exciting projects, which have the biggest actually transformatory potential for change of society, remain unrealized. The reasons for a project to be unrealized can be that it's too big to be realized, that it's too small to be realized, that it's actually forgotten, that it's too dangerous to be realized. It can be also censored. I mean, if you think about all the projects in the world every day which are censored. And then, as Doris Lessing once pointed out to me when we discussed this idea of a palace of unbuilt roads, she says we should never forget about the unrealized projects which are too dangerous that we actually don't dare to do them. So projects which we self-censor. So my idea, and I thought that could be a contribution to your ever-growing archive of dangerous ideas, is to commission an architect to actually build a building in which we would house all the unrealized projects of artists, architects, scientists, poets, etc., from all over the world. And I believe that, you know, it would something amazing would happen if we would gather them all in one space and have them somehow reunited.
That's a dangerous idea from the international art world's it guy right now, curator Hans-Ulrich Obrist. Want to know more about him? Check out his new book called Ways of Curating. On our minds this week is simmering racial tension in America and Claudia Rankine's popular new book-length poem about race. It was nominated for a National Book Award, and it's selling like crazy, which is pretty rare for poetry. The cover is simple. It's a black hoodie set against a white background, and the title, Citizen, an American Lyric. Claudia Rankine sat down with Charles Monroe Kane to talk about it.
If the hoodie's juxtaposition to the word citizen complicates the word citizen, then, you know, that's a problem. I think the use of the word citizen for me is sort of synonymous with American. And if, as an American, you're not allowed to basically walk the streets without being concerned for your life, then, you know, it's a kind of problem.
It's amazing. It always seems to me that the hoodie has become something we replace with black. Because you can't get away, right, in the modern mm-hmm. world of being racist, but you can get away with being against the hoodie, right?
Right. But, you know, it's funny because white people wear hoodies. But, you know, the fact that it's a symbol that loses its toxicity when it's put on the white body is also very interesting.
Do you have something you could read for us from your book that you feel gets at part of this?
Okay. You and your partner go to see the film The House We Live In. You ask a friend to pick up your child from school. On your way home, your phone rings. Your neighbor tells you he is standing at the window watching a menacing black guy casing both your homes. The guy is walking back and forth, talking to himself, and seems disturbed. You tell your neighbor that your friend, whom he has met, is babysitting. He says, no, it's not him. He's met your friend, and this isn't that nice young man. Anyway, he wants you to know he's called the police. Your partner calls your friend and asks him if there's a guy walking back and forth in front of your home. Your friend says that if anyone were outside, he would see him because he is standing outside. You hear the sirens through the speakerphone. Your friend is speaking to your neighbor when you arrive home. The four police cars are gone. Your neighbor has apologized to your friend and is now apologizing to you. Feeling somewhat responsible for the actions of your neighbor, you clumsily tell your friend that the next time he wants to talk on the phone, he should just go in the backyard. He looks at you a long minute before saying he can speak on the phone wherever he wants. Yes, of course, you say. Yes, of course. I like the ending of that piece because one of the things that I think happens with racism is that everybody's response then gets complicated by trying to avoid it or, you know, move away from it. So, you know, that actually happened to me. And and when I said to our friend, you know, the next time you should just go in the backyard, I meant it as a way of avoiding the aggressions and the fear and the paranoia of our neighbor. But in a sense, I was telling him that he should curtail his own rights.
Well, let me ask a different question here. And I want to talk to you about pronouns. Your use of you and I, and again, the you and I always assumed when I first started reading the book, was someone who was black. And then he and she that I assumed was white. Mm-hmm. So that's how I read it. And then things started to get really muddied about a third of the way through the book. And then I was like, wait a minute, who is she talking about here? Is this about me? Is it about the black community? And so I guess it begs the question, who is this book for and who's it not for?
Well, it's for Americans. It's for citizens. And the use of the second person was intentional. What I wanted to achieve structurally was a environment where people would have to orientate themselves relative to the pronoun.
Right.
Because you often hear people say, you know, I don't think about race. I just see people. So I wanted people to read these pieces and see their own minds place one body in a black body or a brown body, place another body in a white body, see themselves relative to that situation and say, oh, wait, I did this. I didn't do this. I would never do this. I clearly am not that person. I've never received that treatment, you know, et cetera. And see if in their own minds they lined up the participants according to race.
There's another poem in your book that really struck me, and I think it's a poem you added in way after it was published and had a new publication so you could put Eric Garner and Michael Brown in. It's a very powerful poem, and it says, in memory of Jordan Russell Davis, in memory of Eric Garner, in memory of Joan Crawford, in memory of Michael Brown, in memory, in memory, in memory, in memory. And it goes on till it fades. And then it says, because white men can't police their imagination, black men are dying. Could you tell me about that poem?
That was written in response to Darren Wilson. When he said that thing, that seeing Michael Brown was like seeing Hulk Hogan, that he was a demon, I don't disbelieve him. I think that for him, the black body is this thing that is larger than life, even though he, you know, Michael Brown is bigger than him in terms of weight, but I think they're relatively the same height. So I wrote that down as a line, because white men can't police their imagination, black men are dying, thinking that it would lead to other lines. But I got stuck there because it seemed to be at the heart of the problem.
Yeah.
That the ways in which the racial imagination is created, has been created for whiteness and blackness in this country, you know, it has at its root this kind of, I don't know what it is, this sense of fear and loathing, basically, of the other.
Now, you went down to Ferguson, right, before the grand jury decision. What was that like?
When I went, I just happened to be in St. Louis, and so I went to Ferguson, and it was very sad, actually. I ran into some young black men, and one of them kept saying to me, I look just like Michael Brown. You know, that could be me. So that sense of identification with a dead body was something I wanted to run from. You know, I found it really appalling. And then I ran into another woman, and she had a toddler with her. And she said to me, do you want to take a picture of the boy with his hands up in the air? And again, I felt like, no, I don't. Hmm. I don't want to take a picture of your toddler in the hands up, don't shoot position, because I don't want that analogy determining his life. And so in a sense, that's me being a little bit in denial about a kind of reality that is true for, you know, for black men in this country and definitely for black boys and men who live in Ferguson.
You know, you're a professor in California and you're very intelligent and you've lived life and you knew before that grand jury decision what that decision was going to be. What was that like too? You knew they were going to be acquitted, right?
I knew they were going to be acquitted and I wanted them to be indicted. So so there was still that 1% of me hoping. And I think if I didn't continue to go forward with the 1%, then I don't know how quiet I would live, you know? And I think this is true, you know, I don't want to speak for all black people, I don't know. But certainly for me, there was and continues to be, again and again in these situations, a kind of jaded, I know they're going to be acquitted, I know they're going to be acquitted. And yet this private hope that they will be indicted. So that's why you wait. You know, you're in this constant sense of waiting. And the wait becomes like years and years and years and years until it's a lifetime.
You are a poet, a purveyor of words. Is this book the words for that wait?
I think these are the words for that wait. I think the book, for me, was a very personal exploration of what it feels to live the wait and what it looks like.
What are the words that we need? I mean, we, you mean the big we, right? Capital W, the United States. What are some of the words we need to move beyond this?
I think that discussion, that the fact that we're now talking about it and going alongside of that always has obviously to be that legislation has to stand alongside. But it doesn't change the hearts of people. It doesn't change that sense that I think I believe one thing and then I act in another way, hence the lack of indictments in moments when it seems very clear and obvious and sensible what should happen. So I think people, you know, we have to just keep talking. Because we all are here together.
Claudia Rankine's new book is called Citizen, an American Lyric. Charles Monroe Cain talked with her. I'm so glad you caught the show this week, but I know you can't plan your life around the radio dial, so there's a solution. Sign up for our podcast. That way you'll never miss another hour of To the Best of Our Knowledge. Just visit our homepage, click on the great big purple button. The address is ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin and Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Cain produced today's show with help from Raymond Tungekar, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Craig Ely. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and thank you so much for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.